This is November 24th, 2012, and today is Jukai Saturday, taking the precept ceremony. The 24th is as early as we ever have the precept ceremony in November. This year, Thanksgiving was as early as we ever have it, the fourth Thursday in November. And as we wrote in an email that went out to the Sangha a few days ago, I'm going to break with my custom of doing an overview, a general look at the 16 precepts and repentance. I'm going to try something different and just pick up certain elements of the Jukai, somewhat random. First of all, sort of stepping back and looking at what all this precept business is. Well, the 16 precepts are the first three are the taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the next three are the three resolutions, resolve to avoid evil, resolve to do good, resolve to liberate all living beings. And then the last 10 are an expansion of those three resolutions. They're a little more elaborate version of avoiding evil, doing good, and liberating all living beings. Those are the ten cardinal precepts, which I won't take time to enumerate right now. To me, the real point of not just taking the precepts, but living up to them, is that they are a way of to avoid causing harm. There. That's it. Harm to ourselves as well as to others. That's what the precepts are about. They're a way to avoid causing harm, unnecessary harm. I suppose in looking at it strictly, we're always causing a little bit of harm by, you know, eating and driving a car and so forth, but we don't want to cause any more than we already do. And that's what they really are. They're not a moral manifesto. This is because of our conditioning as Westerners. This is our tendency, is to see them as moral guidelines. But it's not quite accurate to see them that way. Because it's more, they're really more about, I said, not causing harm. So then we can expand that to say they're about causation. Cause and effect. The precepts are descriptive. They describe our true nature. This enlightened self that goes back from before, or even before we were born, our essential nature. The precepts are a way of articulating how we would function if we had fully realized this essential nature of ours, this enlightened nature of ours, which none of us has done fully. But we strive to respect and honor and uphold the precepts so that we can uphold our true self. It's not something, some future self that we might eventually hope to become. I mean, that's one way of looking at it, because we haven't fully embodied this true nature of ours. We're all different stages on the path toward doing that. But the other way, from the essential side of things, we don't have to get to any other place or become any other kind of person. We're already there. And the key thing is to discover through awakening that we have always had this true nature. We've never been apart from it. Another way to look at precepts in a big, broad stroke kind of way is to see that when we transgress against the precepts, we are falling out of harmony with the way, the Dharma. The Indian word is Dharma. The Chinese word is Tao, T-A-O, the Tao. And the American, the English word is the way, or the path. We are the way. We have always been the way. We couldn't get away from the way if we tried. But because of our ignorance of this fact, because we are ignorant of our intrinsic harmony with the way, we fall into disharmony with the way. I think one of the best things that we could work on as Westerners is to get a different perspective on these words of right and wrong and good and bad. I mean, it's natural enough that we use them in ordinary speech, but they are misleading. They can cause us to believe that there is some kind of abstract characteristic of right or wrong or good or bad. This is something that, from everything I have seen in Asia and what I've read and heard in terms of transcultural studies, this is a real deeply, deeply ingrained notion that we as Westerners have that not everyone has to the degree that we have. And it's all wrapped around a sense of self. If we buy into the notion of a fixed, unchanging self, then it just follows that when we cause harm, that we refer this back to the self, and we then modify the self. We tend to think of it as a bad self, or that we're somehow wrong or bad. It's just not the real essential point. It's this other thing of straying from our nature. There's something that Asian teachers have often spoken of, the strong sense of guilt that we Westerners carry with us, that they don't seem to have in the same way. What Asians tend to have more is shame. So what's the difference between guilt and shame? Shame is the painful feeling of having lost the respect of others. Having lost the respect of others. And this is a huge, influential emotion in Asia. We also have it, of course, but it seems to be much stronger in Asia. And in fact, it's one of the great engines of the tremendous achievements of Asians, is this fear of losing the respect of others. Guilt, on the other hand, is the painful feeling of self-reproach resulting from having done what we think of as wrong, of wrongdoing or bad behavior. It's more the individual. There was an interview in Tricycle magazine with a Tibetan lama by the name of Dzigar Kongtrul Rinpoche, and it was actually Pema Chodron who was doing the interview. And she begins by saying, "Rinpoche, since you've been living in North America for some time and know Western mind and culture well, what do you think is the most beneficial advice you can give to Dharma students here?" And he said, "The most important thing that I see Western students needing to realize is guiltlessness." And by that he means coming to understand that the person, our true self, our true mind, is fundamentally pure. He uses the word innocent. That's because, I'll just speak now, I'll elaborate, because there is no self. And this is the only way to fully grasp the essence of the Buddhist precepts, is to see through the illusion of self, the illusion that we have been dragging around our whole lives, that there is this some unchanging self-standing entity that moves through time unchanged. Belief in a soul contributes to that illusion. That there is some little man in here, or some little woman in there, that moves through time, moves from birth to death, and there's some kind of unchanging self, and this is does not hold up through the experience of awakening. There is a degree of continuity, of course. We see this physically. People we know for years and decades, we see a resemblance. There is an element of which we don't change. But it's not an absolute unchangingness. It's just relatively. We're relatively unchanged. But the truth is that there is no substance. There's no self-substance. There's no entity that remains absolutely unchanged. The changes are usually gradual. Never as fast as we'd like them to be. We who are practicing, they're never fast enough. But we're not stuck with a self. There's nobody in here. There's nobody in the room. Quite literally, say there is no body. The body itself is in flux. It is change. The body is change. The mind is certainly change. The body is change. The mind is change. We see this every time we look into the mind in our sitting, our zazen. We see the mind in flux. Thoughts coming and going, feelings, sensations, memories, ideas. But it's the same with the body. Modern physics confirms this. We're energy. We're energy that is condensed into a certain form that is relatively unchanging. So this sense that of the bad me comes from this from ignorance, the lack of understanding, the selflessness, the no-selfnessness of our nature. when we see into this no self, then it's possible for us to accommodate whatever arises in our lives without feeling so intimidated by the experience. He says, without rolling over like a defeated dog in a dogfight. We see that things arise due to cause and effect, changing causes and conditions. This is our karma playing itself out. We'll get to karma a little more later. It doesn't have to be so personal. It doesn't have to be, I am such and such a person. This is big stuff. This is fundamental, because so long as we are carrying around this notion of ourself, of a self, especially a self being this or that, then we have a lot of baggage, a lot of freight that is getting in the way of change. He points out that guilt has no benefit of any sort, and that it's actually by clinging to a feeling of guilt, this only increases our attachment to the self. Every time we think about the self, we're increasing our attachment to it. She asks, what's the difference between regret and guilt? And he points out that regret is a way of breaking free of our attachment to the self. If we just sit and nurse our sense of guilt, then we're just sort of stuck with this self we imagine ourselves to have. But regret is a way to pull free of it. And that's why Chukai, the precept ceremony, starts with repentance. I've often quoted Thoreau as saying, to regret deeply is to live afresh. Taking the repentance, reciting the repentance verse or gatha, reciting this aloud is a way of really disavowing ourselves of this notion of a self and its bad business. By articulating it aloud, we are engaging the body. We're engaging the throat, the larynx, the lips, the tongue. We're literally embodying this repentance. Very different from just thinking it. This is also why we chant the sutras, the various sutras, the Prajnaparamita and the other sutras, in order to better embody them, instead of just having them as a cerebral experience, if you can even call it an experience. And doing it with others makes it even stronger. Guilt, he points out, can actually be a way of escaping responsibility for our actions. We're not fully accepting them. By expressing, articulating aloud our regret, our repentance, then this is a way to accept responsibility for them, and then we can move on. Email that we sent out a few days ago invited people they wanted a more general overview of all the 16 precepts in a more systematic way, that they could hear one of my teishos from previous years, in which that's what I do. Part of the repentance part, one element in the repentance part of today's ceremony, is where either I or one of the other ceremony leaders says, quotes Dogen as saying, through repentance, the effects of past misdeeds loosen and dissolve. Repentance, he says, lightens the burden and brings release and purity. That is, if it's done with real sincerity. And that's why the Jukai is going to be more meaningful and carry more of a punch if we sit before the ceremony. To come into a ceremony, to come into anything, come into work, come into a meal, if it's after sitting, if you've done some sitting, it's going to be more meaningful. So, if we think of the way, the Dharma, as a stream, that's one analogy that we find in the text, then when we violate the precepts, we are, in a sense, casting ourselves off to the edge of this stream of the Dharma. We create an eddy. An eddy, if anyone doesn't know that word, is just a little pattern of usually circular, little swirl in the water. This is actually a good simile for the ego. This little swirl in the water we call an eddy, it's not a thing, it's a pattern. This, what we call the ego, is not a thing of any substance, it's just a pattern based on habit, usually. In a way, we can say all of the precepts are all about habits, dealing with habits. I came across a review of a book on habits, the power of habit, why we do what we do in life and business. Just a couple little things here. It's by the author is a Charles Duhigg, Duhigg, an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He read hundreds of scientific papers and interviewed them, many of the scientists who wrote them, and it says here in the review by the review is by Timothy Wilson that he's optimistic. The author is optimistic about how we can put the science to use. Once you understand that habits can change, he concludes, you have the freedom and the responsibility to remake them. Once you understand that habits can be rebuilt, the power becomes easier to grasp, and the only option left is to get to work. That points to the very close connection between the precepts and taking the precepts and practice. Practice basically always meaning life, the way we lead our lives, not just sitting. In the review of this book called The Power of Habit, the reviewer points out that there is another type of habitual behavior that involves more cognitive activity, namely people's interpretation of a situation according to what it means for them and how it fits into the narratives they tell themselves. These behaviors are habitual in the sense that people have chronic ways of interpreting the world. And then he gives the example, a black college student's story, for example, may be that she doesn't belong at the majority white university she attends, which causes her to fall into a pattern, there's that word again, a pattern of disengagement and academic failure. Research shows that changing black students' stories about their sense of belonging improves their academic performance and health throughout the college. So back there again, back to the self, the fundamental problem of the self, the illusion of a self, and who we are and who we aren't. In a way, the precepts are all just leaves and branches. The root challenge is seen through the self, but the leaves and the branches are important too. That's why we take these precepts. Now, you'll notice that the precepts, other than the first three, the three refuges, the other 13 precepts are framed in terms of the negative. So with the resolutions, I resolve to avoid evil, that comes first. And then in the 10 cardinal precepts, each one begins with a resolve not to kill, but to cherish life, a resolve not to take what is not given, a resolve not to misuse sexuality, a resolve not to abuse alcohol or drugs, a resolve not to lie. And that's the traditional formulation, is the not, is what we want to refrain from doing. And then somewhere along the line, the positive half was tacked on, which reflects the second of the three general resolutions. The first of those three is our resolve to avoid evil. Second is our resolve to do good. And each of the 10 cardinal precepts reflects that sort of dual nature of our aspirations in the realm of not causing harm. But it's very significant that not part comes first. And I found myself drawn back to one of my all-time favorite books, which is The User Illusion. I gave two or three teishos on this about 7 years ago. The User Illusion, it's by Tor Nuretranders. I think he's Danish. And he, in about the middle of the book, he gets into the neurology of consciousness. Well, the whole book is about consciousness. But in this particular part, he gets into the fascinating half-second delay. That's the name of the chapter, a half-second delay. And he starts by citing the work of an American neurophysiologist, Benjamin Libet. Libet found that there is a half-second lag between the experience of something and the awareness of it. I think that's more or less correct. They found in their experiments that the will to carry out an act, that consciousness, awareness of the will to carry out an act that we decide on to do occurs almost half a second after the brain has started carrying out the decision. This is mind-blowing. This is so our awareness of the will to do something, carry out a decision, happens half a second after the brain has already started carrying out the decision. The desire to carry out an action becomes a conscious sensation long after, neurologically speaking, the brain has started initiating it. But consciousness does not occur before the action is performed. Our actions, in other words, he says, begin unconsciously. Even when we think we make a conscious decision to act, our brain starts half a second before we do so. Our consciousness claims that it makes the decisions, that it is the cause of what we do, but our consciousness is not even there when the decision is made. It lags behind, but it does not tell us that. It dupes itself. So I'm not going to go into the science of this. It's very beautifully laid out, the kind of experiments they did, but it is very compelling evidence, and I haven't heard it refuted since in the, 10 or 15 years since this book came out. For example, if the cortex was stimulated for less than half a second, the patient felt nothing. But I'm going to go to the implications of this. He raises the question that may have occurred to many people listening to this is, what about free will? What part does free will play then? And this is the point, that consciousness, although it occurs after the brain has gone into action, it also occurs before our hand does, before physically carrying it out, we have the opportunity to veto what the impulse is. So again, consciousness cannot initiate an action, but it can decide that it should not be carried out. That's our free will, in vetoing what we have the impulse to do. And then Libet, neurophysiologist, said many ethical strictures, such as most of the Ten Commandments, are injunctions not to act in certain ways. He concludes that we can control our actions, but not our urges. We can control our actions, but not our urges. This is something that so many Zen students could benefit from learning, is to have an urge, to have a desire, to have a craving, is nothing, certainly, that we need to feel guilty about. What we have to monitor is whether we act on that urge, that craving. That's where we cause harm to ourselves and to others. So he talks about the golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But he contrasts that with the Jewish version of that, which is not to do to others what you would not have them do to you. So the Old Testament version is more in line with what we've learning through modern science. In the light of Libet's veto theory, the difference between Judaism and Christianity stands out very clearly. If our consciousness has no possibility of controlling the urge to act, because it is not even informed when the urge arises, it is difficult to see how we can be responsible for our urges and dreams. The Christian precepts not to desire your neighbor's wife and not to feel like doing away with your boss imply problems if the knowledge Libet gained by experiment is correct, for our consciousness cannot control our desires. And then he says, conversely, Libet's findings also point the finger at the problem of Judaism, that people have the right to think and feel whatever they like about each other as long as they do not act it out. Only the actual carrying out of a volitional movement can be of practical significance for other people. Judaism, he says, easily becomes a spiritual license to entertain cruel, indeed evil, feelings and hopes as long as you do not act in a way you would preferably not be subjected to yourself. Whatever you think or feel is okay. The absence of a code of mental ethics in the Jewish tradition can lead to the form of inner cruelty and evil that Shakespeare portrays in The Merchant of Venice. But here, this is where Buddhism takes over, because it recognizes the very close link between thoughts and feelings and actions. Thoughts and feelings, on the one hand, the inner experience of thoughts and feelings, and then speech and actions. These are the three things that we often refer to in practical Buddhism, in Zen, is thoughts, speech, and action. In the Repentance Gatha, we say, all evil actions committed in my since time immemorial, stemming from greed, anger, and delusion, arising from body, speech, and mind. So the first part of that gatha, that verse, uses the word actions, but a few words later, it clarifies that so-called actions really have these three elements to them: thoughts and speech, and then the actual behavior. And that's where meditation comes in. We have to take responsibility not just for our actions, not just for our speech and our actions, but for our thoughts and feelings and so forth. And the two are very much connected, thoughts and emotions, certainly. Emotions are often sustained by our thinking about them. But it all starts with how we're using or misusing the mind. That we can do something about. So the science that is reported in this book, The User Illusion, very much conforms to the Buddhist experience in the sense of even to think that we're doing anything is a kind of illusion, because there's no we. This is what in Buddhism is called the emptiness of the three wheels. It's a funny analogy, but funny word, wheels. But what it means is the subject, the object, and the act. So no self, no fixed permanent self, means that the subject, the doer, doesn't really exist in any absolute way. Same with the object. And then if there's neither subject nor object that's has any substance to it, or them, then certainly the action itself has no substance to it, because it itself is flux. So ultimately, in the ultimate sense, the very notion of doing something or deciding something is flawed, because there is no doer in any absolute sense. There's nothing being done. And so this is where we get to these basic Taoist, not only Buddhist, but Taoist concepts of wu wei, non-doing. Related to this is an article I came across in the New York Times from not this year but last year called Stumbling into Bad Behavior. Regulators, this is by the co-authors of a book called Blind Spots, Why We Fail to Do What's Right and What to Do About It. Their names are Bazerman and Ten Brunzel. And just to read a couple paragraphs here, they say that regulators, this is basically a business article from the business section of the New York Times. Regulators, prosecutors, and journalists tend to focus on corruption caused by willful actions or ignorance. But in our research and in the work of other scholars who study the psychology of behavioral ethics, we have found that much unethical conduct that goes on happens because people are unconsciously fooling themselves. Unconsciously. They overlook transgressions, bending a rule to help a colleague, overlooking information that might damage the reputation of a client because it is in their interest to do so. Now we get to the very heart of meditation practice is awareness. And they report on an experiment, one study. Participants were asked to play the role of a manufacturer in an industry known for emitting toxic gas. The participants were told that their industry was under pressure from environmentalists. To ward off potential legislation, the manufacturers had reached a voluntary but costly agreement to run equipment that would limit the toxic emissions. Some participants were told they would face modest financial sanctions if they broke the agreement. Others were told they would face no sanctions if they did. So two groups, they both knew it was wrong to, let's just oversimplify this, that it was wrong to not run this equipment that would limit the toxic emissions, and one of the two groups were told that they would face financial sanctions, and the other were told that they would not face financial sanctions. And then the authors report, an economic analysis would predict that the threat of sanctions would increase compliance with the agreement. Instead, participants who faced a potential fine cheated more, not less. With no penalty, the situation was construed as an ethical dilemma. The penalty caused individuals to view the decision as a financial one. So then they conclude, when we fail to notice that a decision has an ethical component, we are able to behave unethically while maintaining a positive self-image. No wonder then that our research shows that people consistently believe themselves to be more ethical than they are. Well, not if you do a lot of meditation. And that's again this intimate link between the meditation and the precepts, is because if we're not just nodding off in our sitting, then we're going to notice ways in which we fall short of these precepts. And that's where the even just a couple times a year taking these precepts can help. It's also like hitting a reset button. All right, I've done all this stuff, half of which we're only vaguely aware of. These patterns we have of reacting to people, reacting to circumstances and conditions. And it builds up. It just creates this sense of, well, a sense of self. It reinforces this notion of a self. Anytime we have patterns that we keep repeating, then there's going to cause this heighten this feeling of the self. And this, I'm going to end with a look at what character is. This is one thing that keeps. I keep chewing on. For years I've been chewing on what is character in terms of practice and change. To what degree can we change our character, whatever that is? And in Buddhist psychology, there is a thing called the a kind of a formless body that we all have that relates to this character. This is from the Abhidharma. The Abhidharma is the enormous number of books on Buddhist psychology and philosophy. The first skanda, you know, we in the Prajnaparamita we talk about the five skandas and the emptiness of the five skandas. These are the five components of the notion of a self. The first is the form, the body, another form, the material world, and this realm of form is comprised of the material or physical side of things, plus a type of formless form, or what they call in the old Sanskrit text, avijnapti rupa, which is defined as the subtle body that registers or holds intentional acts. It's sometimes compared to moral character. The words from the sutra is, it is a derived body, exempt from mass, which does not act as a support of fine and mental states, but rather functions as a sort of serial continuity or moral structure. Avijnapti rupa engenders a power action which continues reproducing itself after its initial cause has disappeared. In meditation, the avijnapti derives from those elementary qualities which are not organized into a sentient being. It is not sensed. It creates a positive or negative moral context for future actions. So this is what we are. We are forming and reforming through everything we think and say and do. We are working with this moral body, this moral thing that really itself is empty, fundamentally, has no substance to it, but there is a way in which through repetition we can reinforce or fortify this moral character, this character of causation, or not. And that's in our hands, is whether we keep repeating the same thoughts and speech and actions. All right, I think that's enough. And I hope that people who were not clear about the 16 precepts and the repentance verse that we'll be doing in Jukai later today might want to hear one or more of the teshos I've done, address them more. Methodically, the 16 different precepts, but that's all the time we have. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.